Wedding plans were a social matter, and social matters on a military post bowed always to the needs of war. Chaplain Badger and the smiling couple set the date, only to be forced to call it off. Patrols were ordered in, and personal affairs were brushed aside upon official notification that General Ronald Slidell McKenzie was marching north from the Rio Grande to mount the southern phase of a military offensive designed to envelop and crush the hostiles on the Texas plains. Other columns under other commanders would move west out of Fort Sill, southwesterly from Camp Supply, northwestward from Fort Griffin, and eastward from Fort Union. Between them, they were to harry and chase the Comanches, the Kiowas, and the Cheyennes, bouncing them off one another, squeezing them in an ever-tightening vise of power and steel. The arrival of the Mackenzie column was a wondrous thing. Never had Gideon seen so many men, so many horses, so many wagons drawn together at one time and place. They would have swamped the fort and its limited facilities, still far short of the Army's frequently mentioned long-range construction plans, so Mackenzie chose to camp his force on the river, just off of the post. In his honor, the Concho soldiers brushed their blues and polished their brass to a shine seldom seen and put on a full-dress parade. That gave Gideon his only good look at the Indian fighting colonel, a gaunt, haunted man with pain in his eyes and Sheffield steel in his voice. Mackenzie watched the parade solemnly, reluctantly, living up to the demands of military protocol, though his mind was clearly on the campaign ahead. Off duty, Gideon and Jimbo walked down to the grand encampment. They ignored the racial jibes and catcalls that came from a few white soldiers.
Hey, boy, you lost! Two towns up that way!
They stared in wonder at the strange and fierce-looking Seminole Negro scouts, faces black like their own, but language alien and dress more Indian than military. Gideon mustered the courage to speak to a black man who wore a headdress made of buffalo hide and horns.
Howdy. Welcome to Fort Concho.
The man gave him only a glance and no answer at all. Gideon never knew whether he couldn't understand or simply chose not to. Oddly, though the scouts were black, Gideon felt no racial kinship to them. It was as if they had come from some world a million miles from his own. He had more in common with the white soldiers. This concept, too, he found hard to accept. Jimbo had the same feeling, but was not in the least disturbed by it.
I seen a white nigger once, when I hauled cotton to the gin for old Colonel. He had a face like milk, but he's still a nigger. Same with them scouts. They got black faces, but they still just Indians.
All of the Concho garrison expected to be sent with Mackenzie, but none of it was. The colonel had his own command, mostly white. When he finished the tiresome amenities of military pageantry and had the necessary repairs made to his wagon, he raised a great pall of dust over the northward trail and left the Concho complement intact. There was, at first, a feeling of letdown, of anticlimax. Chaplain Badger decided it would be a shame to waste all that polished brass, so he quickly rescheduled the wedding of Lieutenant Frank Hollander and Miss Adeline Rutledge of Cleveland, Ohio. His chapel tent was too small and much too Spartan for an occasion of such importance. He proposed, and the concerned parties quickly accepted, that the ceremony be conducted on the front porch of the Macklin House. That way even the black soldiers could attend without actually being admitted en masse into an officer's home. It was a foregone conclusion that all of Hollander's company would be there. After Sunday noon mess, the men rebrushed their uniforms, rubbing brass buttons already ashine from the tribute to Mackenzie. Jimbo had never complained about the spit and polish aspect of barracks life. He was in his earthly glory when he could wear his dress blues. Gideon stood in the doorway, leaning against the jamb, looking solemnly across what he could see of the parade ground.
Gid, it ain't long till time.
Gideon's thoughts reached beyond the parade ground to the lieutenant, probably trembling by now and dropping everything he picked up. He thought of Adeline Rutledge and the hope he had seen in her unblinking blue eyes.
There ain't nobody gonna order you to do nothing, Ledbetter. Now you just listen to your conscience.
Gideon stared a little longer, flexing his fists. His mind ran back to Hannah York. The other men filed out of the room, looking shiny enough to parade for Ulysses S. Grant. Jimbo waited patiently, edging toward the door.
You coming, ain't you, Gid?
Gideon avoided his eyes.
Don't wait for me.
He saw Nettles watched silently from the door to his room. Gideon sat down heavily on his bunk, his shoulders slumped. He heard Nettles' footsteps, but didn't look up.
Your conscience must not be talking very loud.
Gideon shook his head. Every word carried pain.
If I was to go out there now, it'd be like saying what he done didn't matter no more. That everything was all right. But it does matter. It still hurts. And I can't be no hypocrite about it. I ain't one of them bowing and scraping niggas that grins to a white man's face and wishes he could kill him.
If you want to transfer to another company, I expect I can fix it.
You think I oughta?
When a man's troubles are all in his head, he generally carries them along wherever he goes to.
Nettles left. Presently, he began to catch the distant sound of music floating to him on the faint breeze from the south. He got up and walked outside.
Dearly beloved, we are assembled here in the presence of God to join this man and this woman in holy marriage.
Leaning against the corner of the building, beneath the portico, he could see a crowd gathered at the Macklin House. A few guests seated on the shaded porch, many officers and their wives standing just in front of the house. Nettles had marched the Hollander Company across to the south edge of the parade ground. There they stood, part of the service, yet subtly apart from it. The little girl Susie stood at attention beside Esau Nettles. The bride in white and the lieutenant in his blues stood in front of the chaplain. Gideon could hear the sound of voices, but not the words. He looked down, his throat so tight it pained him, his fists clenched. He rushed back into the barracks and put on his blues. He trotted across the parade ground and fell in at the end of the line.
Vested in me, and with great pleasure, I now pronounce you man and wife.
The two turned. Gideon could not bring himself to look at Hollander, but his gaze touched Adeline Rutledge a moment, and she was smiling at him. Myth has credited the Indian with animal instincts approaching omniscience. It has presented him as able to see one bent blade of grass on a broad plain, to follow the track left by a crow's shadow, to sense where his enemy is at all times and know what he will do next. This, of course, is false. Like every other human, the Indian could wander and become lost in unfamiliar country. He was often given to doubt about his own wisdom and that of his leaders. Worst of all, history records that his enemies frequently took him by surprise. Colonel Mackenzie's great column, ponderous though it was, came unseen upon the western rim of Palo Duro Canyon at dawn, the morning of September 28, 1874, and looked in amazement down the steep walls at an Indian encampment stretching for miles beside the creek that snaked along the canyon floor. Here, it appeared at first, must be all the hostiles on the southern plains, Comanche, Kiowa, Cheyenne, Arapaho, and they were still asleep. The appearance of the cavalry should not have been a surprise, but unaccountably it was. After several skirmishes over the preceding few days, as the column had plodded northward across the plains, both Indians and military had lost track of one another. Indian scouts sent to watch the soldiers had missed seeing them break camp in the cold, dark hours after midnight. Now, as the eastern rim of the canyon turned rose and orange, Sergeant John B. Charlton and two Tonkawa scouts found a narrow game trail that zigzagged dangerously down the steep and treacherous wall. The command dismounted quietly, and at Mackenzie's signal, Captain Eugene B. Beaumont started A Troop moving in single file, leading their horses. They reached the canyon floor beside an encampment of the Kiowas. By the time alarm spread up and down the creek, it was too late. Too many of the soldiers were in the canyon. Instead of a concerted defense, there was panic. Instead of coordination and tactics, there was chaos. Like flushed quail, the Indians scattered in every direction, up and down the canyon floor and the steep canyon walls. Gray Horse was striking his flint and steel to build a fire in the center of the cold teepee when he heard the shots from far down the canyon. His first thought was that it would be a foolish deer which came to drink out of a creek where so many teepees stood. Some fortunate family would eat better today than he and Limping Boy. But as the firing intensified, he threw a blanket over his shoulders and grabbed his quiver and bow.
Limping Boy, get up! Something is wrong with the Kiowas!
He did not wait to see his cousin throw his robe aside. He rushed through the flap, untethered his horse, and leaped upon it bareback.
Great Horse! Wait!
He heard Limping Boy behind him, but he couldn't wait. A dark foreboding enveloped him, and his skin tingled with the need to be moving. Galloping toward the Kiowas, where the firing had begun, he saw many people rushing out of their teepees. Men, women, children. Some of the men did as Gray Horse had done, leaped onto their mounts and ran to the sound of the battle. But many milled in confusion, shouting orders to women and children who cried too loudly to hear. Pack animals and war ponies, boogered by the running and shouting, strained at their tethers. Some broke loose and stampeded blindly, adding to the melee. Ahead of him, the firing had quickened. It was suddenly much nearer. The ground trembled with the sound of running horses. Through a haze of dust, he saw blue-clad troopers at the gallop, driving before them a tremendous herd of loose horses and mules, most bareback, some pitching wildly with saddles or packs turned under their bellies. He loosed an arrow at a soldier who passed near him like a whirlwind, but he knew he missed. He looked behind him for his cousin and the dust and turmoil and the flurry of hysterical humanity.
Limping Boy! Limping Boy!
Through the rush of colors, he saw him, afoot. He put his horse into a run, reining up as he reached his kin. Limping Boy, dusty and bleeding, took his arm and swung up behind him.
A terrified woman ran into me on a mare and knocked my pony down.
Limping Boy had been trampled in the moment of pandemonium, and his pony had run away with the others. He had held onto his bow, his quiver, and his shield, but he had lost his blanket and everything else. Firing continued, but it was random and scattered, more desperation than defense. Gray Horse felt cold all through.
The battle is lost! We had just as well go away from this place!
He crossed the creek, for he saw few soldiers on that side. Limping Boy clung to the pony with his knees. In the timber that fringed the creek, they came upon a horse which had tangled its tether in the brush. Its markings were Kiowa, but Gray Horse saw no Kiowa laying claim. If one ever did, they could give it back. Limping Boy slipped to the ground, untangled the rawhide rope, and formed it quickly into a makeshift bridle. He looked regretfully back down the canyon.
It is not good to run away from a fight.
The hornets are out of the nest and buzzing all around us. There is no way of fighting hornets.
He led the way and they went on up the canyon. It took some time for either the Indians or the military to realize the immensity of what Mackenzie had done. Audacity and luck had given him the greatest victory the army had ever scored against the Indians on the plains. His cavalrymen managed to capture most of the canyon's horse and mule herd, leaving a majority of the fleeing Indians afoot. In their escape, they left behind them virtually everything except what they wore or carried on their backs. Teepees, robes, blankets, meat supplies, camp equipage, all of it was captured and put to the flame. The great herd of horses and mules was taken up the west rim of the canyon. After the soldiers and the Tonkawa and Seminole Negro scouts had selected the animals they needed for their own use, more than 1,000 head were shot so they could never again fall into Indian hands. That stark, bleaching pile of animal bones lay for years as a grim marker of the last grand encampment of the Free Plains Indians. It was the climactic, crushing blow, leaving only the continued wholesale slaughter of the buffalo to finish the tribe's defeat. Yet it was accomplished with little loss of life. Though grimly determined in his mission, Mackenzie did not kill for the love of blood. Beneath the iron demands of duty, he had a respect for the Indian as a worthy enemy and did not kill him when there was no need. The only army casualty in Palo Duro Canyon was a bugler shot in the stomach, but back on duty in weeks. No more than a handful of Indians were killed. Gray Horse tried as hard as any to escape, but from every promontory upon which he rode, he saw sign of soldiers. At times, they gave chase, and he and Limping Boy had to run. At other times, they simply pressed after the fugitives in their own dogged and deliberate pace, giving them little rest. Hunger was a constant companion. Winter had driven most of the game into cover. They huddled miserably in their thin blankets whenever they could find a night's shelter from the wind, and most often they slept without enough food in their bellies to help warm them. They passed many a night wet and cold and sleeping not at all. As Grey Horse feared, Limping Boy's debilitated condition left him easy prey to the winter chills and fever. Grey Horse took him into a shallow, water-hollowed cave in the red clay and gypsum banks of an ice-fringed creek and built a small fire at the opening's mouth, where the wind would pull the little bit of smoke away. For 2 days, Grey Horse did not know if his cousin would survive. The waiting gave him far too much time to think, to remember. Always, although he tried not to dwell upon it, he came back to the fact that he had known nothing but misfortune from the day he and the others had struck those Tejano settlers and their picket cabin on the Colorado, the day the bleeding woman had touched him and had died with his medicine bag clutched in her contaminating hand. Could all this be punishment for the spoiling of his medicine? Could all the people be paying the penalty because he had gone against his medicine in allowing Bear to disregard Coyote's clear message? Could the bleeding woman have been placed there by the spirits to test him? Could the chastisement suffered by all those around him be part of a scourge set loose by spirits angry over his failure to listen to them? For answer, he heard only the howling of an evil north wind. Limping Boy's fever broke, finally, but he was almost too weak to sit on a horse. It would take little to make him sick again, this time probably worse than before. Grey Horse hunted hard and finally managed to find a thin old buffalo bull alone in a sheltered hollow. It reminded him of the one he had watched the wolves pull down at the bottom of the Double Mountains. He built a small fire, but they ate the meat more raw than roasted. He watched his cousin wolf down the first decent meal in 2 or 3 weeks, and he knew there was no longer any alternative. For himself, he had rather die than go to the reservation, but he could not think of himself alone. If his recklessness had put Limping Boy in this condition, it was up to him to make the sacrifice, to save this young cousin who had so long been a brother to him. He took to riding at night when the soldiers could not see. He sought out the reservation camps and inquired after his own band. He found many tribes gathered here in sad and weary clusters, Kiowa, Cheyenne, Arapaho, Comanche, living in their teepees as of old, but nothing else was as it had been. They were beaten, shamed, on the verge of despair. Always, when he asked after his own, he was pointed somewhere else, and always the information proved wrong. Though he would not speak of it to Limping Boy, he saw the same fear in his cousin's fever-sunken eyes. Perhaps their band had been destroyed. Perhaps they, too, were the last survivors, like the one calf of his recurring buffalo dream, searching vainly in a field of bones. Then, one bitter night, when snow lay heavy on the ground and flakes of it stuck cold against his face, he rode toward a blaze he could see flickering on and off like a firefly as the falling snow thickened and thinned. He made out the familiar form of buffalo skin teepees set in a rough circle, as had so often been the custom among his band when the camp terrain permitted. He and Limping Boy rode between the lodges and approached the fire. Like a wraith out of the night, an old man stepped into the dancing light.
Welcome, travelers. It is a cold night. If you are hungry, there is meat.
A terrible chill took possession of Grey Horse. He knew that voice. It was Black Robe, the uncle he called Father. He tried twice before his own trembling voice took hold.
Father, do you not know me?
Sliding down from his horse, he threw aside the blanket that had covered him, and he stepped closer to the fire. The old man threw his arms around Grey Horse.
My son, we had long since mourned you for dead.
I have been like dead for a long time. I would not be here now, but Limping Boy is sick.
The old man had a strange smell on his breath. Grey Horse thought it was the white man's whiskey. Black Robe hugged Limping Boy and called him son, though he was not, and pointed to a lodge which glowed faintly from the light of the fire inside.
You will find your mother there, son. She has been ill, but you will make her well.
Limping Boy hesitated a moment, staring at Grey Horse. He gripped his cousin's shoulder, then turned and led his Kiowa pony toward the teepee which Black Robe had shown him.
And my mother? How is she?
She lives. She is not happy, but she lives. She will be happier when she sees you. Do you not want to know about your wife and your son?
I know what happened to them, Father. The soldiers killed them.
The old man stood back, astonished.
No, my son. They were not killed. The soldiers took Green Willow and some of the others prisoner and held them a long time at the big soldier village. Your son was born there.
My son? Then I do have a son?
Yes. Not as healthy as I would want him to be, but this is not a healthy place.
Where are they?
In your lodge.
He pointed. Grey Horse stood a moment as if frozen to the snow, staring toward the teepee.
It is better that you wait until later to see your mother anyway. She is not young. She might die of the surprise. I will tell her and get her ready. Go first to your own.
Grey Horse started walking, leading the horse, slowly at first, then faster. By the time he reached the flap, he was almost running. He did not take time to tie the horse, but simply dropped the reins in the snow. He raised the flap, bent, and went in, letting it drop shut behind him to close out the cold. On the other side, across the fire, a wide-eyed woman sat wrapped in a blanket, her eyes going even wider at the sight of a ghost. She let the blanket fall away. In its folds sat a boy of a year, thin-faced but as wide-eyed as his mother.
Grey Horse!
They clasped each other with all the strength they had. The spirits had put Grey Horse through his punishment. Now he knew they had at last relented. It often seemed to officers and men that some malevolent spirit guided the army in the timing of its calls upon those who wore its yellow and blue, and those who waited for their return. Adeline's baby was due any day. Now it was Frank Hollander who must leave to continue earning the captain's bars which finally had come to him after his years of waiting for the slow wheels of army procedure and seniority to turn. A party of discontented Comanches had bolted the reservation and roamed loose upon the plains, striking at buffalo hunter camps, killing those they could, setting others afoot, and running off with their horses and mules. He was to ride north, set up a base camp in an appropriate place of his own choice, then search the plains until the hostiles were found and driven back to the forgiving and protecting arms of the Quaker agents at Sill. The orders came from General E.O.C. Ord himself. Hollander formed his company after breakfast the morning of July 10th. 60 soldiers, more or less, and a newly assigned lieutenant named Judson, who had come down from Sill with Colonel Grierson when the 10th Cavalry headquarters was transferred to Fort Concho. One green private had tried to feign sickness that morning so he wouldn't have to go, but Esau Nettles rolled him out of his bunk and made him walk a straight line across the floor of the barracks.
Get dressed, soldier. You're well enough to ride to hell and back.
That's where it's liable to be. I tell you, Sergeant, I heard a hoot owl up behind the window for the last two nights. Them's bad omens.
A hoot owl ain't gonna hurt you, but I might. Now, you want a bad omen? Look at me, because I'm as bad a one as you'll ever see. Now, dadgummit, get your britches on!
At Hollander's nod, the new lieutenant gave a curt order to Nettles, and Nettles formed the horsemen into a column of twos to take their leave of the post. As they passed Hollander's stone house, Adeline came awkwardly down the steps and out the newly painted white gate in the picket fence, finally put up to set off the parade ground from the houses of Officers Row. Hollander looked first at his wife, then back to Nettles.
Carry on, Sergeant. I'll catch up.
Gideon watched the captain throw his arms around the young woman. He saw tears shining on her face. Unbidden, regret came over him. He remembered times he had left Hannah without even the chance to tell her goodbye. The sergeant became aware that everyone was watching.
Eyes, front!
Riding beside the young lieutenant, Nettles led them away. Soon, Hollander overtook them in a long trot. Gray-faced, he passed the lumbering wagons, then the column, without looking either to right or left. He took his place at the head of it. Gideon overheard Nettles questioning the lieutenant.
Where'll we pick up Mr. Maloney at, sir?
We won't. His wife is about to have a baby, and he's staying with her at Ben Fickle.
Unspoken, but plain as if he had said it aloud, was the implication that a civilian had personal choices denied to the soldier.
She's army, sir.
Hollander nodded grimly.
Sometimes that's a hell of a thing to be.
They made 20 miles that day, following the North Concho. From the few facts the men had been told by their officers, and the many rumors that had floated to them on the air, Gideon surmised that the trouble area lay several days' ride to the north. They continued following the river the second day, the July sun bearing down as if in anger, to the point that one of the unseasoned new recruits, named Nash, swayed and fell from his saddle at mid-afternoon.
Get up from there and be a soldier.
But the man was not malingering.
Sunstroke. Let's carry him over to the shade of those pecan trees.
He made a broad waving motion.
All you men, shade up. Rest yourselves and your horses a while. Drink a little water, but not too much.
The trooper was revived after a time by wet cloths placed on his forehead and water sparingly given him.
Jimbo, Ledbetter, you all ride along with him and keep a watch. If he shows sign of blowing out his light again, holler.
Trooper Nash managed to stay in the saddle the rest of the afternoon, though he hunched over and seemed disoriented most of the time. When evening camp was made, Gideon and Jimbo got his uniform off him and led him into the edge of the river to lie down in the cool water.
The man's dried out from the skin to the core. Now he needs to soak up all the water he can.
Jimbo went off to see about their horses while Gideon sat at the edge of the water to make sure Nash did not fall unconscious again and drown. Eventually, the recruit recovered enough to eat a small supper of hardtack and bacon, washing it down with black coffee, bitter as sin. The heat-suffering young Nash was newly come out of St. Louis. He had been at the post just long enough to ride on a couple of scouting trips that had turned up nothing more than a few stray buffalo that had not drifted north in the spring. He nudged Jimbo, who seemed to attract new recruits in the same way he had of drawing dogs or quieting horses. To a half-scared young trooper just coming onto a strange post, Jimbo's ready grin was like a lantern in a window at home. The young soldier made it through the day without anyone having to hold him on his horse, and Gideon saw nobody else showing serious symptoms. Hollander held to a slower pace and camped early in the evening beside springs at the head of the river. By then, Nash was fit enough to care for his own horse and to stand a tour of guard duty. Tough, Gideon reflected. But it took tough men to come into western Texas from less strenuous climbs in the middle of the summer and stay on their feet. He had seen men faint away on the parade ground. The fourth day's ride was longer than expected. Hollander had intended to camp at the White Springs, but found them dry. A dark look passed between the captain and Esau Nettles. At length, Hollander suggested what he called the Big Spring, which he believed had never been dry. 3 more days they traveled to Wild Horse Springs on the Upper Colorado River. Hollander began searching for a suitable place to set up his base camp. Moving northeasterly, they headed toward Bull Creek. Suddenly, Hollander reined to a stop, staring across the prairie. Squinting against the glare, Gideon saw a horseman coming in a long trot. He dropped his hand to his carbine. At the distance, the rider could have been an Indian, though Gideon could think of no reason a lone Indian would move directly toward a company of cavalry, except ignorance. He had seen no sign of any that ignorant. The rider was a white civilian. 100 yards out, he raised his hand in peace, which to Gideon seemed unnecessary. He was hardly likely to open hostilities on a column of troops.
By George, we're sure glad to see you, soldier boys.
Hollander took off his hat and wiped his sleeve across his forehead. The heat had robbed him of humor.
I don't believe, sir, that you will find a boy in this company.
No offense, Met Captain. I'm an old soldier boy myself. Maybe I don't look it now, but I was.
Which army?
Union, of course. Do I look like a Johnny Reb?
Without the uniform, I find it increasingly difficult to tell.
Well, you'll find some old Rebs in our outfit up yonder.
He half turned in the saddle and pointed his chin in the general direction of a low, flat-topped mountain that lay to the northwest.
Yankees, too. Old enemies pull together when a new one appears.
I suppose. I was told to be on the lookout for a group of buffalo hunters who have banded together against the breakaway Indians.
That's us. Well, we gave up hunting buffalo. We've hunted Injuns instead.
Well, my orders were, if I found you, to see if we can work together. You show us the Indians, and we'll fight them.
The hunter rough-counted the troopers in dry amusement.
Captain, I believe they're more than enough to go around for all of us. Those Injuns killed a couple of men, and then ran off the whole horse herd from Rass Trading Camp on the Double Mountain Fork late in the winter. Ever since then, we've chased them a while, and then they've chased us.
The hunter rode alongside the captain, telling him of the frustrations his group had suffered in their efforts to kill buffalo against Indian resistance.
We're down now to 23 men and a Mexican guide. Of late, we've gone to calling ourselves the Forlorn Hope. That's what it is if our luck doesn't switch around pretty soon.
The column came presently to a small creek where a group of men were camped in the welcome shade of scrub timber. Gideon's mouth was dry, and he could almost taste the cool water just looking at it, but he had to wait for orders. Several men walked out to meet the column. With few exceptions, they were bearded and shaggy, for the social graces were without consequence in this environment, and whiskers helped protect the face from blistering sun and scorching wind. The man who appeared to be the party's leader shook hands with Hollander as the captain dismounted. He gave the troops a quick and not totally favorable appraisal.
Ah, darkies. I had hoped they'd be white men.
I doubt that the Indians will know the difference, or care. Lieutenant, make camp. I leave you in charge.
Hollander walked out among the hunters to read a paper to them, who drew into an informal circle around him, subtly reminding him they were civilians. Lieutenant Judson had been busy supervising the making of camp. On his return, Hollander briefed him on the conference.
Hunting buffalo or hunting Indians, they have been back and forth over this country enough that they know most of it. They agree to join us for the mutual good.
Do you think it'll work? Mixing military with civilians?
The war was fought mostly by civilians, Lieutenant. They put on a uniform, but at heart, they were always civilians.
But one side lost.
Hollander decided the creek was suitable for his base camp. He spent much of the following day setting it up, unloading the wagons. Cutting the teams from 6 mules to 4, he dispatched the empty wagons back to Fort Concho for additional rations and forage. The other 8 mules he kept to carry packs. The men welcomed the rest, though it was not for their benefit. The hunters did not want to move until their Mexican guide and a couple of men with him returned from scouting to the west and northwest. The men bathed and washed the crusted sweat from their clothes. They brushed their horses and fed them grain to give them strength they would not get from the half-cured grass which bordered either side of the narrow creek. There had not been a lot of grass on the trip. This had been another dry year. Gideon noticed that Hollander seemed to study his silver pocket watch a lot when he was not busy supervising establishment of the camp. Jimbo disclosed that his wife's picture was on the inside of the case. After supper, the tall Thompson came back to sit a while with the captain, smoking his pipe and sharing reminiscences. The hunter had been in the war and afterward had been a field officer under Mackenzie for several years on the frontier before some Eastern Review Board decided his services were no longer required by an army that needed to cut personnel and pare expenses to the heartwood. The hunter lighted his pipe with a splinter of dry wood ignited beneath the captain's blackened coffee pot.
I take no pleasure in killing Indians, Captain. I wouldn't say this to just anybody, but there are times I almost sympathize with them. When I can forget the friends of mine they've killed. When I can forget the sight of men I rode with butchered like beef. I can see why the Comanches and the Kiowas and all those others keep running off from the reservation. They still figure this to be their country. They never had a government before to tell them where they could go and where they couldn't. They did what they wanted and went anywhere they were strong enough. This land fed them, gave them clothes and shelter. They were part of it like all the other wild animals, like the wolf and the buffalo. If I were them, I'd fight too.
But you're not them.
No, I'm white, and white men need this land now. A man has to side with his own. I doubt that the Comanches were the first Indians here. There were others before them, and the Comanches drove them off. Likely as not, those others drove off somebody who was here before them. That's the way of the world. The strong take and the weak yield. It's the white man's turn to take. Destiny never backs down for sentiment. Neither does nature.
And who will come along someday to take it away from us?
Nobody, Captain. At least not from you and me. Because we won't stay to claim it. The soldier never gets to keep what he wins. He wins it for someone else and then moves on. We hunters won't stay either, most of us. When the buffalo are gone, the land will be ready for the farmer, the stock raiser. We are tools of destiny, Captain. You and me and your darkies here. We'll do our bit and drift away with nothing to show for it.
When Thompson returned to his own camp, Lieutenant Judson moved closer to the captain.
Couldn't we find some way to live with the Indians?
Hollander poured a fresh cup of coffee.
The Indians, these plains tribes anyway, are too different from us. They don't see life in our terms, and we can't see it in theirs. The white man gains respect by his work, by what he builds, by what he accumulates and keeps. These things mean nothing to the Indians. They are warriors. A warrior gains respect by his feats in battle. Put an Indian where he can no longer fight, and how is he to live? What is he to live for? Where is he to earn respect? Try to put us together, and the white man will always covet the Indian's land. The Indian will always be looking for a fight so he can win honor. We're incompatible. Somebody has to yield altogether, and that somebody has to be the Indian.
The lieutenant stared into the red embers beneath the coffee pot.
When you think about it, it's sad.
The captain gazed a long time across the rolling prairie toward the distant blue hills where the Indians were likely to be.
You're a soldier, Lieutenant. A soldier learns not to think about it.
The Mexican scout returned the third day. If he had a last name, Gideon never heard it. All he heard was Jose. He seemed to regard the black soldiers with disdain, which Gideon found funny in a dark way, for the white people treated both Mexican and Negro as inferiors. The two darker people should have considered themselves kindred spirits, but did not. Gideon guessed the Mexican told the captain about Indian sign, for Hollander left 20 troopers and two buffalo hunters to guard the supply camp, while 40 troopers and the rest of the hunters set out with a string of pack mules and several days' rations. The sun bore down like a demon aroused, and Gideon found he was by no means the only one who looked back regretfully at the tree-lined creek and its shade. The name of Double Lakes kept drifting back along the column on the next day's hot, dry march. Gideon began to build visions of clear blue water, the kind he had seen a few times on the lower plains when summer and fall rains filled the natural playa basins. Gideon's disappointment was keen when the column finally topped a gentle rise in the sun-browned prairie and came in sight of the so-called lakes, their dry bottoms cracked, their powdered alkali skin shining fiercely in the sun. The column rode down to the edge of what had been a lake. A thin line of rotting debris showed last year's high water mark. Dried, dead weeds testified that once there had been moisture enough for them to make their crop of seed, which lay dormant now beneath the curled and brittle litter, waiting for nature's next erratic demonstration of its dedication to the survival of all things.
The shovel, Sergeant.
Gideon and Jimbo happened to be nearby, and Nettle's eyes lighted upon them first. They untied shovels from one of the pack mules and walked out upon the dry lake bed, the captain beside them.
Dig here.
Dry as the lake appeared on the surface, Gideon was surprised to find mud just inches beneath.
Keep digging. The water down there might not be pretty, but it will be wet. Fish sometimes survive in that mud. When it rains and fills up the lake, you'll find them.
Gideon was not looking for fish. He just wanted a good drink of water. What gradually seeped into the first hole he dug seemed more mud than anything else, but while he was digging additional holes, he noted some clearing in the first one. Hollander waited a little, then dipped water in a collapsible cup. Grimacing, he wiped his sleeve across his mouth.
The Comanches have a strong prejudice against digging holes in the ground. Something about some evil spirit they're afraid of setting loose. I believe that prejudice may be justified.
Much digging and much patience produced enough water to satisfy the horses and mules, to fill the canteens and the coffee pots for supper. The coffee was made strong enough to mask the water's flavor. Gideon would not have asked a dog to drink such water under ordinary circumstances, but now he drank it himself gratefully. The company made camp at the edge of the lake while Jose and several hunters scouted westward. Toward noon the following day, two vague dark forms began to show through the quivering heat waves and materialized into hunters on sweat-streaked, foam-flecked horses. Thompson brought them to Hollander.
Hey, Indian sign, Captain. Jose sends word he found the tracks of 30 or 40 hostiles west of Dry Lake.
He pointed westward.
It's fresh sign, or was when these men left him. He'll keep following and let us catch up to him.
The horses were saddled, the mules quickly packed, leaving nothing and no one at the Double Lakes camp. The mid-afternoon sun was as heavy as some hot giant hand pressing down on Gideon's head. It seemed to strike the parched ground and bounce back up into his face. The light breeze brought little comfort. It too carried the breath of a blacksmith's forge. After a while, Gideon lifted his canteen and took a couple of swallows of the water he had hated yesterday. Today, it was as sweet as mother's milk. His action was infectious. Jimbo, licking dry lips, untied his own canteen. Gideon listened to its sloshing sound.
Jimbo, that canteen ain't full. Didn't you fill it up before we left the lake?
Jimbo shook his head.
I was too busy helping pack the mules. It's half full. Didn't you hear him say we was headed for another lake?
Presently, Sergeant Nettles dropped out at the head of the line and sat on Black Napoleon by the trail, warning the troopers as they rode by him.
Be sparing with your water. Liable to be a while before we fill them canteens again.
He could have saved his breath. As the men felt thirsty, they drank. When the column reached the rim of Dry Lake a while before sundown, most of the canteens were empty. Hollander sent Gideon and Jimbo forward to try the small pool of shallow water they could see shining red in the tired but hostile sun, far into the middle of an otherwise dusty, crusted lake bed. Gideon never tasted the water. He didn't have to. The thirsty Jimbo pushed the dust-colored skim aside with the flat of his hand and scooped a palmful of water. He brought it to his lips.
Great God Almighty!
They carried the bad news to Hollander, but he and the troopers already knew from watching Jimbo.
Spare your water, men! We'll get none here!
The order was late in coming. Most of the troopers had no water. While they were at the edge of the lake discussing their disappointment, the Mexican guide and the rest of his hunter party rode in from the west. Jose pointed northwesterly. The Indians were moving that way. Hollander spoke with the hunter interpreter.
I think the Indians have tricked us. Him. They've led us back and forth across the sands, these dry flats, keeping us away from water.
The captain studied the men and horses of his command. Three troopers had dismounted and lay on the ground in the shadow of their horses. Little Finley was one, groaning as if in anticipation of death. Most of the rest were hunched in the saddles, their eyes closed against the relentless sun, their lips dried and cracking from the sun and the hot, scorching wind.
What if we forget about the Indians for now? What if we strike out for the nearest water? How far would it be?
The guide's words were definite, but his manner was not. Hollander turned to the lieutenant.
He's lost. He got so absorbed in following the Indians that he forgot to keep track of landmarks.
Oh. Now, I don't know this country like he does, but if we stay here, we'll starve for water.
Lieutenant Judson listened silently, his head down. He was almost out of it. The two men talked a while, their voices rising in anger. In a few minutes, they agreed upon the only course open to them from the start. They had to follow the guide.
He may still be lost. We know we are.
Jimbo seemed to have pulled himself together after almost falling from his horse. He was looking around more. Together, he and Gideon steadied the young Nash when he showed signs of letting go. Behind him, Gideon heard a dull thump as another trooper fell and began trembling convulsively on the ground. Waters looked around quickly, shaking. He tried to speak through his dry, swollen lips.
Ain't no water left.
A buffalo hunter quartered his horse into the cavalry company and dismounted slowly, heavily, with a canteen in his hand. It sloshed a little.
Save this for myself.
But he unscrewed the cap and let the water trickle slowly across the trooper's dry lips, catching drops with his finger when they were about to run away, forcing them back into the delirious man's mouth. Captain Hollander sat quietly on his horse, watching the men work with the fallen trooper. Hollander bowed his head. Gideon could not tell whether he was praying or simply hiding his eyes from the relentless sun. When Hollander looked up again, he sought out Jimbo.
Come here to me.
The captain got to the ground carefully.
How do you feel, Jimbo? How is your horse making it?
Jimbo replied with more confidence than Gideon thought was justified.
Fine, Captain, sir. We both fine.
Jimbo, if anybody can keep a horse going, you're the man. For the moment, consider yourself a corporal. I'm going to detail you some men whose horses still look as if they'll make it. You're going to take canteens and follow the trail left by that Mexican. You think you can do it?
Jimbo had seldom lacked for confidence.
Sure, Captain, sir. Want us to go and fetch back water for the rest of you?
Gideon felt a clutch of fear.
Captain, sir, Jimbo's apt to need help. I want to go with him.
Hollander cut his eyes to Gideon. He shook his head.
Ledbetter, I'll need all the steady old hands I can keep. You stay here in reserve.
Gideon wanted to argue, but realized it was useless. He watched in helpless silence while Hollander picked 7 more men to go with Jimbo. Gideon studied his friend's face and found no apprehension or doubt. Jimbo didn't comprehend the risk. Maybe that was just as well.
Jimbo, you ain't never been away from me before, hardly. You watch out now.
Jimbo came as near smiling as his swollen and bleeding lips would allow.
Oh, Colonel, he ain't raised no idiots.
As the men tied empty canteens to their saddles, Hollander gave his orders slowly, repeating every point.
You watch that trail closely. For God's sake, don't lose it. When Jose finds water, give your horses a drink, rest them a little while, then back trail to meet us with those canteens. You understand, Jimbo?
Jimbo nodded.
Then go, and good luck.
Jimbo saluted and led the men out, following the guide's tracks in the hot sand. Gideon's fear would not let go.
Captain, what if that Mexican don't find water?
Hollander did not answer him in words, but his eyes gave the answer Gideon dreaded. He watched Jimbo and the others disappear into that shimmering veil and was surprised he still had water enough in his system to produce a tear. Gideon felt his brown horse, Judas, breaking down. His steps labored. He dismounted and began to walk, leading the horse. Around him, other men did the same. A common fear ran through the command. Every soldier had been told and drilled and told again that losing his horse on these open plains was tantamount to suicide. A man afoot was a man soon dead. One of the horses, which had dropped back almost to the rear of the column, fell to its knees and lay over on its side, kicking convulsively.
Oh, don't do me like that. Don't give up. I need you.
He tugged in vain at the horse's head. At Captain Hollander's command, a couple of soldiers managed to work the trooper's saddle free and slip the bridle off. The saddle was added to a pack mule's burden.
Oh!
A soldier fell in behind the others, walking. After a while, 2 men were down and showing no signs of getting up. No water was left anywhere in the command. The buffalo hunters had exhausted the last of their own on themselves or on sunstruck soldiers. Hollander held his hand before his eyes and squinted toward the lowering sun.
The column can't waste the daylight that's left. We can't wait on those men. Sergeant Waters, you still look strong. Stay with them until they can get to their feet, then bring them on.
Waters had never argued with white officers. But he came near it now. Gideon saw raw fear in the man's white-rimmed eyes.
Captain, you hear them men are groaning? You leave them here, they'll die. We'll all die.
Sergeant, when you accepted those stripes, you accepted responsibility. Now do what I tell you, or by God, I'll be forced to do to you what I did to that horse back there.
Nettles moved up.
Captain, I'll talk to him.
While Hollander pressed on, Nettles sternly told Waters to get hold of himself and be a soldier, a man. Walking away, he caught the question in Gideon's eyes. Gideon had never seen Waters so frightened.
It was their groaning got to him that away. Now, he's heard many a one groan before.
Gideon looked back once and saw Waters standing alone with three horses, two men lying on the ground. He realized that as long as he had known Waters, the man had always seemed alone. Somewhere up there were Jimbo and the canteen carriers. Any minute now, God willing, they might show up on the trail ahead, bringing back water and salvation. Gideon could see nothing in the gathering dusk except a round hill dead ahead of them, rising a little higher than the plain around it. By now, he was having to walk along beside the young Nash and hold him in the saddle. Ahead of him, Sergeant Esau Nettles was leading Napoleon and holding on to little Finley. Nettles' own feet were dragging. His limp was pronounced. If they walked much farther, someone would have to help the sergeant. Hollander, his face blistered by the sun, kept riding back along the stretched-out line to make sure no one stumbled and was left behind. His short growth of whiskers had taken on a coating of alkali dust and blow sand. His lips, like everyone else's, were swelling and breaking. He pointed.
The hill. The top of the hill. We can see and be seen.
The grade was modest. At another time, the hill would have been no climb. But Gideon labored, each step harder than the last. Esau Nettles fell. Gideon moved forward and took hold of him. Leaning heavily on Gideon, the sergeant pushed to his feet. Little Finley's horse had gone on. Nettles tried to catch up with him, to resume his support of Finley.
Let him go. Time Finley taking care of himself. You better ride Napoleon the rest of the way, Sergeant.
I don't want to kill my horse.
Rather kill yourself?
He helped Nettles get his foot into the stirrup and then gave him a boost into the saddle. His leg slid heavily over the horse's rump. His hand went to his hip, where the Comanche arrow had struck him long ago. Before good dark, they were on the hilltop. Unsaddling was slow and clumsy. Unpacking the mules was worse because of the weight. When its pack was removed, one of the mules stretched to urinate. Little Finley held out his cup and caught it full while Gideon watched in disbelief. He went to his knees. He tried again and managed to swallow some of the hot, sharp urine. Gideon saw that other men were watching, some in disgust, some in hope. The next time a horse stretched, two men were there with cups. One vomited almost instantly, but the other managed to force most of his cup full and keep it down. On the side of a small knoll, two Comanche warriors watched as the cavalrymen and the hunters collapsed on the round-topped hill. Gray Horse grunted his satisfaction to Limping Boy.
They will bother us no more. By tomorrow night, if their medicine is not strong, they will all be dead. And the white chiefs can never say we killed them.
Limping Boy shook his head.
We led them here.
But it is the land that kills them, not us.
Gray Horse walked back to his tethered pony and untied the deer paunch bag tied to his rawhide saddle. Watching the soldiers had made him very thirsty. He swung onto the pony's back. He and Limping Boy started eastward, after those who had ridden on before them. They had many horses and mules to take back to the reservation.